Our presentation is entitled Moses 1 and the Apocalypse of Abraham, Twin Sons of Different Mothers. I'm glad that Stephen T. Whitlock is here with us today, one of our co-authors. We regret that David J. Larson is not able to join us. More detail can be found in a longer article that appeared earlier this year in Interpreter, a journal of faith and scripture. In 1897, a German translation by G. Nathaniel Bonvetsch introduced the Western world to the Apocalypse of Abraham, or as I will call it throughout the rest of the presentation, Ap-Ab. The significance of Ap-Ab was not lost on Latter-day Saints, who published the first English translation of the work in the Improvement Era in 1898, just 1 year after Bonvetsch's German edition appeared. Hugh Nibley, Jared Ludlow, and others have studied the work in conjunction with the Book of Abraham. Although I will mention some of the affinities with the Book of Abraham today, our focus will be on its relationship to Moses chapter 1. To begin, I'd like to say a few words about methodology. An examination, like some other presentations today, our methodology relies primarily on comparative research. Comparative research examines historical and literary relationships between a primary text and other texts to look for evidence of influence or common origins. Though it is fair to say that some comparative studies have not always been as carefully conducted as they should have been, it would be a mistake to reject the idea of comparative study outright. As Todd Compton explained, drawing parallels isn't a necessary technique for any scholar. One must simply judge each parallel separately to see what validity it offers, recognizing that this technique requires careful analysis of the passages to be compared. Details about standards for comparative analysis are discussed in our published paper. Importantly, comparative research not only provides clues to the origins and influences, but also frequently illuminates the meaning of both the primary text of interest and the text to which it's being compared. It would be ideal if we had a manuscript much closer to the time and milieu of Moses than Ap-Ab to use as the basis for our comparison. However, late and imperfect documents from antiquity may nevertheless provide keys for understanding, even when they may be riddled with the ridiculous. C.S. Lewis once addressed the potential of ancient sources, even those of poor quality, to inform modern scholars in surprising ways. And he illustrated his point by saying, "I would give a great deal to hear any ancient Athenian, even a stupid one, talking about Greek tragedy. He would know in his bones so much that we seek in vain. At some moment, some chance phrase might, unknown to him, show us where modern scholarship had been on the wrong track for years." In a few instances, our experiences in comparing Moses 1 to Ap-Ab have revealed the truth of Lewis's claim. For example, as part of our study of Moses 1, a seemingly gratuitous and initially inexplicable phrase stood out in verse 27, as the voice was still speaking. Surprisingly, we found that the Apocalypse of Abraham repeated similar phrases in analogous contexts. This discovery provided a welcome clue to the possible meaning of this obscure phrase in both texts, a finding we'll describe further below. There are three common types of comparative analysis that are used to study the texts and translations of Latter-day Scripture. First, comparisons to the Bible and other translation resources known to Joseph Smith as evidence of 19th century influences. Second, comparisons to ancient sources unknown to Joseph Smith as evidence of a process that relied on divine revelation. And three, comparisons to other texts focusing on literary features rather than explanations of influences and origins. It is not a sound practice to focus on one of these evidence to the exclusion of the others, since these three types are complementary. To avoid the blindness of unseen evidence that comes from over-specialization, results from all three types should be considered together when evaluating evidence for origins and influences. The most common argument advanced in comparisons of Moses 1 to the Bible and other translation resources known to Joseph Smith as evidence of 19th century influences is that it was inspired by Jesus' encounter with Satan in Matthew 4. However, a preliminary study by Colby Townsend has demonstrated that Matthew's account is a fairly unfruitful source of comparison. In this diagram, the number of resemblances in vocabulary of Matthew 4 to the narrative themes of Moses 1 have been classified according to the section of the Moses 1 account in which they appear. Townsend found 12 resemblances in all. At first glance, the number of similarities that relate to the verbal battle of Jesus and Satan seems impressive. However, closer examination reveals that all 11 resemblances come from only three verses in Matthew, and each one is based on an occurrence of one or the other of two key terms, worship and depart. Moreover, every resemblance identified, except the first, scores on the weaker end of the spectrum of the classification scale used, corresponding to a 1 or 2 out of a possible strength of 5. In short, although Moses 1 and Matthew 4 share some general elements of one particular type scene in common, the specific resemblances are weak, repetitive, and limited to relatively small portions of the Moses 1 narrative. By way of contrast to studies of the first type that focus only on possible 19th century influences, our focus today will be on comparison to ancient texts as an evidence of a process that relied on divine revelation. We'll primarily look at thematic resemblance of Ap-Ab to Moses 1, a text that Joseph Smith could not have known. By the term thematic resemblances, we mean instances where reasonably similar topics of discussion occur in both texts, even when the perspectives on that topic may differ. The criterion of thematic similarity rather than identical vocabulary is appropriate because we are comparing two English translations. The summary of resemblances shown here paints an interesting picture. It is evidence that the resemblances are not confined to limited sections of Moses 1, but rather are spread through the entire text from start to finish. The resemblances themselves are highly varied and tend to be unique within a given section of the narrative. Importantly, not only the occurrence, but also the sequence of common elements in the two texts is similar, satisfying a stronger comparative criterion that resemblances should form part of, quote, a highly intricate pattern rather than a simple matching of an isolated motif, end of quote. Significantly, with one exception, every one of the major resemblances between the two texts occur in the very same sequence. We discuss the exception in more detail in the full paper. Now let's discuss Moses 1 itself. Several of the individual episodes in Moses 1 are well known to the students of the Book of Moses. Moses' confrontation with Satan, his comprehensive vision of the earth and all its inhabitants, and God's declarations about his work and glory. Yet how all these pieces join beautifully into a coherent whole have been generally underappreciated. At first glance, some elements of the vision might even appear to be repetitive. For example, at the beginning of his vision, Moses saw, quote, the world and all the children of men. Then near the end of the vision, he seems to have experienced the same thing again when he saw, quote, the earth and the inhabitants thereof. Why is this so? The answer to this question becomes apparent when one recognizes how these two different visions fit into the context of the chapter as a whole. The U-shaped, two-part narrative pattern of Moses 1 consists of a down road followed by an up road. In brief, the prophet's experience in Moses 1 not only constituted a prophetic commission, but also a tutorial on the plan of salvation from a personal perspective, analogous in many respects to modern temple endowment. More specifically, the sequence of events recounted in Moses 1 began with Moses' departure from God's presence in the beginning and ended with his glorious return to the divine presence through his faithfulness. Thus, the two seemingly similar visions at the beginning and end of Moses 1 are not repetitive. In verse 8, early on in the vision, it appears that Moses saw the premortal world and the premortal spirits that God had created. We can compare that with Abraham 3. Later in verses 27 through 29, he seems to have experienced a view from heaven of the mortal earth and its mortal inhabitants. Sandwiched between the two visions received at the high points of heaven, Moses' experience at the low point of the narrative recapitulated the downward journey of Adam as he left the Garden of Eden, landing on earth as a natural man, as Hugh Nibley put it. Afterward, Moses was left to himself to be tested in a dramatic encounter with Satan. Only then was he prepared to rise heavenward again through the power of the priesthood and its ordinances. As we describe in more detail elsewhere, Moses 1 fits squarely into the temple-related genre of scripture that scholars call heavenly ascent. Significantly, the account in the central chapters of Ap-Ab is also a remarkable exemplar of heavenly ascent. In addition, as Jared Ludlow has observed, Ap-Ab is, quote, the only Jewish text to discuss foreordination, Satan's rebellion, and premortal existence, end of quote. While not exactly identical twins, important elements of both Moses 1 and Ap-Ab seem to draw on a common well of ritual and experience in a manner that belies the apparent fact that they were independently produced in time frames that were separated by millennia. For starters, the primary components of narrative structure within Ap-Ab of Abraham's heavenly ascent can be matched to the sequence of major events in the heavenly ascent of Moses 1, as we've already seen. However, in addition, both Moses 1 and Ap-Ab culminate in a vision of the creation and the fall. Going further, in a 2014 BYU Studies quarterly article, I've argued that Moses 2 through 8 can be seen as a temple text, following a similar pattern to the one Jack Welch described in his brilliant analysis on New Testament's Sermon on the Mount and the Book of Mormon's Sermon at the Temple. The seven concluding chapters of the Book of Moses contain stories related to the covenants necessary for ritual ascent, the kind of figurative ascent that takes place in earthly temples. In other words, the heavenly ascent of Moses 1 seems to provide a prelude to the ritual ascent of chapters 2 through 8, as Douglas Clark and others have suggested. In short, as Elder and Sister Hafen taught us last night, the Book of Moses is a blueprint for the temple ordinances that were later shared publicly with the saints in Nauvoo. One of the many witnesses that the heavenly ascent of Moses 1 and the elements of ritual ascent in Moses 2 through 8 were the result of early revelations, not late inventions. Now we will walk through the thematic similarities of Apab to Moses 1, occasionally supplemented with affinities to the Book of Abraham and other ancient sources when these echoes were too striking to be omitted from the discussion. Prologue. The prologue declares that Moses will be caught up to an exceedingly high mountain where he will receive the glory of God and enter into his presence. Setting, both Moses 1 and Apab mention a high mountain. Sacrifice. In Apab, as in the Book of Abraham, the high mountain is to be a place of sacrifice and revelation. Though this detail is not explicitly mentioned in Moses 1, it does not seem unreasonable to suppose a similar setting. The illustrations of Abraham's sacrifice shown here are from the Codex Silvester, the oldest and most complete version of Apab. At left is a previously unpublished copy of an illustration from the original manuscript of Apab that Stephen Whitlock and I obtained from an archive in Moscow, while the illustration at right is a retouched version from a rare facsimile edition we photographed in Oxford. Moses in the spirit world. Following the prologue, God's divine attributes are described, and Moses' foreordained calling and status as the Son of God and the similitude of the only begotten is confirmed. Moses was then shown what we take to be his vision of the spirit world. Eritology. Both the Book of Moses and Apab begin with a description of God's majesty. The titles Almighty in the Book of Moses and Mighty in Apab recall the demonstration of God's power over the waters as the first act of creation and the destruction of the Egyptian army in the sea. Significantly, Moses will later be made stronger than many waters, as if thou wert God, end of quote. Both endless, Book of Moses, and primordial, Apab, are related to the characterization of God as being without beginning of days or end of years. Endless corresponds to a concept in the medieval Kabbalah that is depicted visually as a set of concentric circles with their, quote, end embedded in their beginning and their beginning in their end, end of quote, recalling the description of Latter-day Saint scriptures of God's course as one eternal round. God to show a vision of eternity. In both texts, a vision of eternity is promised. In Jewish tradition, the secrets mentioned in Apab include two things. One, a knowledge of the system by which the whole cosmos is put together, in other words, what the Lord describes to Moses as the workmanship of my hands, and two, the revelation of what God is about to do, in other words, the things that will be shown later in vision to Moses and Abraham. Reason for God's favor. In the Old Testament, the promise of seeing the face of God is realized through the wholehearted searching of the petitioner, a prerequisite mentioned in both the Book of Abraham and in Apab. The prophet is commissioned. Each prophet receives a personal title, Moses as my son and Abraham as my friend. Both titles denote an individual who is personally acquainted with the Lord and, like members of the divine council, has first-hand knowledge of the divine will. Vision of the spirit world. Both Moses 1 and Apab seem to include a vision of the premortal spirit world. Moses is shown, quote, the world upon which he was created, and, quote, all the children of men which are and which were created. Likewise, in Apab, Abraham is shown a great crowd of men, women, and children, quote, before they came into being. Cosmic circle with opposing premortal forces. Later, after passing through the celestial curtain, Abraham will see what translator Richard Rubinkovich terms a picture on a visionary screen that is projected on the backside of the heavenly veil, as it were. By means of this image, accompanied by God's explanations, he will obtain, quote, a knowledge of things as they are and as they were and as they are to come. Rubinkovich is careful to clarify that the term used for picture likely refers to something more like a model or a likeness of heaven and earth rather than a photographic reproduction. Hinting at the geometrical shape of the model Abraham will be shown, Yahuwah tells him, quote, I will show thee the fullness of the whole world and its circle. In biblical cosmology, such descriptions symbolize the layout of the universe. Circles are used to, quote, indicate the horizon where the earth comes together with the sky, or more generally, wherever celestial boundaries, veils, expanses, firmaments, separate one symbolic sphere from another. Hugh Nibley, noting the arguments of other scholars for Egyptian influences in Apab, saw some resemblances in form, if not in content, to circular descriptions of the universe in hypocephali, such as the one found in facsimile 2 of the Book of Abraham. Some of the spirits are chosen. In the Book of Abraham, the Lord points out the many noble and great ones that were chosen before they were born. Likewise, in Apab, a premortal group of spirits shown on the right side of the portrayal is set apart to be born of Abraham and to be called God's people. Now we're going to be leaving the many resemblances from Book of Abraham, which seem to occur especially during the premortal life description, which is more full in the Book of Abraham. Moses falls to the earth. Having left the presence of God and no longer be clothed with his glory, Moses fell to the earth, meaning literally the collapse and weakness, and symbolically that he descended again to the relative darkness of the telestial world. Fall and loss of strength. Following their initial divine encounter, both prophets experience a fall to the earth that leaves them vulnerable to the will of the adversary. Abraham is reported as saying, quote, I fell down upon the earth, for there is no longer strength in me, end of quote. Closely resembling the description in Moses 1, where we are told that he fell onto the earth and lost his natural strength. While modern readers might easily skim over the description of the fall and the raising of the two prophets, thinking of it a little interest, it was clearly a significant event to the ancient illustrator, who found it important enough to include it among the six passages he highlighted with visual depictions. The drawing shows Abraham being raised up out of sleep, or perhaps death, by Yahuwel, who, using the right hand, lifts him firmly by the wrist. The rays emanating from the hand of God, emerging from the orb at the top of the illustration, impart the spirit of life, recalling the creation of Adam when God breathed the breath of life into the first man and he became a living soul. Medieval Christian depictions, such as this one of the resurrected Christ, raising up the dead to life by the same ritual gesture, further guide our intuitions about the importance of the raising of Moses and Abraham and how it may have been understood by the illustrator of Apab. Moses defeats Satan. Satan tempted Moses, now in a physically weakened state, to worship him. After Satan is defeated, allusions to priesthood ordinances can be discerned. Satan disrupts the worship of God. The adversary tempts the prophet, in his physically weakened state, to worship him, or in the case of Apab, to leave Yahuwel and flee. Satan's identity is questioned. Both Moses and Abraham ask their adversary for credentials, which, not unexpectedly, he fails to provide. In the book of Moses, the prophet questions Satan directly. By way of contrast in Apab, the angel Yahuwel mediates Abraham's questions. Satan contrasted with the prophet. In both accounts, the prophets see through Satan's attempt to disguise his identity. Lacking divine glory and heavenly inheritance, the devil is easily and humiliatingly exposed. Satan told to depart and cease his deception. In similar terms, the book of Moses and Apab both relate the first of multiple commands for Satan to depart. Moses said, get thee hence, Satan, deceive me not. While Apab has Yahuwel saying, depart from Abraham, you cannot deceive him. The prophet received the glory that Satan lost. Satan is reminded that the glory he previously possessed now belongs to the prophet Moses, to the prophet. Moses' words constitute a second humiliating exposure of Satan as an enemy rather than a son of God, reminding him of the divine declaration that Moses, quote, actually is what his adversary falsely claims to be, end of quote. In Apab, Satan's false pretensions and the prophet's right to glory are both confirmed by the affirmation of Yahuwel that Satan's heavenly garment is now reserved for Abraham, and that his erstwhile glory will be exchanged for the bodily corruption of the sort that Adam experienced after the fall. Satan told to depart a second time. In both texts, Satan is forcefully told a second time to leave with no further discussion. Moses curtly commands, depart hence, Satan, while in Apab he is told, vanish from before me. Satan's final attempt to win the prophet's worship. In Apab, Abraham momentarily gives in to Satan's ploy to continue the dialogue, answering him deferentially, here I am, your servant. To ward off further danger, the angel gives Abraham a stern warning, answer him not, lest his will affect you. In the book of Moses, the goal of Satan's demand is expressed with shocking directness: worship me. Significantly, the cosmic battles depicted in Moses 1 and Apab are not head-on clashes between the titanic forces of opposing gods or demigods. Rather, they are conflicts of mortals who are caught between these forces, being compelled to choose by devilish adversaries, while at the same time being enabled to stand by heavenly powers. Mark Filenko's analysis of this unusual aspect of Apab applies equally well to Moses 1, quote, "The interaction between the good and malevolent powers does not occur directly, but rather through a medium of a human being, Abraham. Abraham thus becomes the place of battle between two spiritual forces. In this struggle, the prince of light and the angel of darkness are fighting in the heart of a man," end of quote. Satan's definitive departure following the invocation of the name of the Son of God. In contrast to Satan's warrantless demand, Moses executes his authoritative command, thus forcing his adversaries to depart through the power of the priesthood after the order of the Son of God. The dramatic turning point of this episode hinges on Satan's desperate false claim to be the only begotten, countered by Moses' triumphant invocation of the name of the true only begotten. No corresponding passage is found in Apab. However, a medieval Ethiopian text provides an interesting example of a similar motif that shows how Satan can be forced to depart through a authoritative invocation of divine names. Moses calls upon God and is answered from a voice behind the heavenly veil. Having continued to press forward, Moses called upon the name of God in sacred prayer. Afterward, Moses was answered by a voice from behind the heavenly veil, enumerating specific blessings, including the promise that his commands would be obeyed, quote, "as if thou wert God." Ascent to heaven. Here we see Abraham and Yahweh ascending to heaven on the wings of the two birds provided by God, but not divided at the time of the sacrifice. The imagery recalls Nephi's poetic description that, quote, "upon the wings of his spirit hath my body been carried away upon exceedingly high mountains," end of quote. As in earlier illustrations, Yahuwel holds Abraham firmly by the wrist using the right hand. In the book of Moses, imagery implying different priesthood ordinances begins to occur as soon as Satan leaves the scene. As one example, having banished Satan by calling upon the name of the only begotten, a motif that precedes baptism in some ancient Christian sources, Moses was immediately afterward, quote, "filled with the Holy Ghost." Seeing God. Moses 1:25 tells us that Moses beheld God's glory. By way of contrast, Apab has Yahuwel declare to Abraham differently, "the Eternal One you will not see." Importantly, however, the divine whisper or echo, Hebrew bat kol, through which in Jewish tradition divine revelation continued through the hearing of God's voice, even after the open visions of the prophets had ceased, was depicted for centuries as a divine hand. In portrayals of ritual or heavenly ascent, this hand was often shown as emerging from behind a cloud or veil, representing the obscuring boundary that separated earth from heaven. A relevant example is shown here from the Dura Europa Synagogue. Significantly, it is the, quote, "earliest known depiction of the hand of God in either Jewish or Christian art," end of quote. Isaac, shown behind the scene of his near sacrifice, and clad in white clothing bearing a prominent mark, enters through the veil of a tent sanctuary at the top of Mount Moriah. This reading is supported by Jewish and early Christian texts suggesting that, in the Akedah, or the binding of Isaac, Isaac literally died, ascended to heaven, and was resurrected. Note, however, that the scene could be equally well interpreted as a ritual simulating death, resurrection, and ascent to heaven, such as what seems to be experienced by the worshippers at Dura Europos. I've described in detail what seemed to be the features of ritual ascent at Dura Europos Synagogue in a 2010 BYU Studies quarterly article. The disembodied hand shown emerging from a cloud or veil is a visualization of God's body in pars pro toto and of his heavenly utterance from behind the veil, in other words, the bat kol. Importantly, in Moses 1:25 through 31, it describes the revelation of God as a progressive phenomenon, beginning with a voice and ending with a face-to-face encounter. Note that the same sequence of divine disclosure is followed in the story of the brother of Jared's intimate account with the Lord at the veil. In that account, his prayer is answered first with the divine voice, then with seeing the finger of the Lord's hand, and finally with a view of the body of his spirit. Passing through the veil, the voice of God. In Apab 17:3, Yahuwel mediates God's self-revelation to Abraham, as he previously mediated Abraham's dialogue with Satan. Yahuwah, standing with the prophet in front of the veil, gives encouragement to a fearful Abraham, provides instructions to him about what to say at the veil, and promises to remain with him, quote, strengthening him as he comes into the presence of the Lord. By way of contrast, Moses experiences the voice of God directly. At first, Moses hears God's voice, but does not yet see him face to face. His experience parallels that of Adam and Eve when they also, quote, called upon the name of the Lord in sacred prayer. We read that, quote, they heard the voice of the Lord from the way toward the Garden of Eden speaking unto them, and they saw him not, for they were shut out from his presence, end of quote. As I have argued in detail elsewhere, in the corresponding symbolism of the Garden of Eden and the temple, the tree of knowledge hides the tree of life, just as the veil hides the presence of God in his heavenly sanctuary. To proceed further, the veil must be opened to the petitioner. In Moses 1 at Apab, the moments when the veil are opened are signified explicitly, if somewhat cryptically. We observe that in Moses 1:25, a significant inclusio opens with a description of how, after calling upon God, the Lord's glory was upon Moses, and he heard a voice. In verses 30 and 31, the inclusio closes in similar fashion, but states significantly that Moses sees God rather than hearing him. Moses called upon God, and the glory of the Lord was upon Moses, and he talked with him face to face. Sandwiched between the opening and closing of this inclusio is a phrase that is intriguing because at first blush it seems both gratuitous and inexplicable, as the voice was still speaking. To our surprise, we discovered that Apab repeats variants of a similar phrase four times. Further examination of these occurrences revealed a commonality in each of the junctures where it is used. In short, each of the four instances in Apab, as with its single mention in Moses 1:27, the appearance of the phrase seems to be associated with the opening of a heavenly veil. More detail on the various openings of the veil are described in our published paper. Passing through the veil, the voice of the petitioner. It's been argued that this image from the Dura Europa synagogue shows Moses reciting a hymn as he completed his ascent to heaven. Likewise, in Apab, Abraham is enjoined by the angel Yahuwah to recite such a hymn. One Apab scholar notes an interesting feature of the hymn, namely that Abraham must repeat it as a requirement for passing through the veil and entering into God's presence. As this scholar expresses it, unlike any other pseudepigraphal account of heavenly ascent, Apab, quote, treats the hymn sung by the visionary as part of the means of achieving ascent, end of quote. Near the end of Abraham's recitation, he implores God to accept the words of his prayer and the sacrifice he's offered, to teach him and to, quote, make known to your servant as you have promised him, end of quote. Then, quote, while he was still reciting the hymn, end of quote, the veil opens and the throne of glory appears to his view. Many waters. After Abraham's traversal upward through the veil, while the angel was still speaking, he sees a fire and hears a voice like the sound of many waters. The theme of many waters is a rich one that we've discussed at length elsewhere. Jeff Lindsay and Noel Reynolds and perhaps others will touch on that theme also today. At the heavenly veil, Moses sees the earth and all its inhabitants. While the divine voice was still speaking, Moses was permitted to pass through the heavenly veil and from within looks downward and outward towards God's handiwork. The prophet beholds the earth. The change in perspective as Moses passes upward through the heavenly veil is related in subtle beauty in the book of Moses. Previously, as Moses stood on the earth, he, quote, lifted up his eyes unto heaven. Now, after ascending to heaven, he, quote, cast his eyes down to the earth. Similarly, Abraham is told, look now beneath your feet at the expanse, meaning the heavenly veil, and contemplate the creation and those who inhabit it, end of quote. Apab scholar Alexander Kulik notes that, quote, Abraham's exploration of the heavenly world in a downward direction as the heavens open below is unique in the relevant heavenly ascent literature. Remarkably, this same feature, otherwise unique to Apab, also appears in Moses 1. The inhabitants of the earth. In their visions, both Moses and Abraham not only saw the inhabitants of the earth, but also, like other prophets, witnessed the earth's entire history from beginning to end. The prophet questions God. Once they've completed their ascent, both Abraham and Moses pose questions to God. Moses asks about the creation. Tell me, I pray thee, why are these things so? By way of contrast, Abraham asks different questions about the origin of evil in the world and in humankind. Moses stands in the presence of the Lord. After God describes his purposes for this earth and its inhabitants, he showed Moses the creation and the fall. Moses was commanded to record an account of these events, something like, but almost certainly not identical to, what we have today in the rest of the book of Moses. God's purpose and will are his own. While the book of Moses refers to mine own purpose and the wisdom that remaineth in me, in Apab, God speaks of how his will is similar to the will of your Father that is in him. Seeing the Lord face to face. In explicit contradiction to the previously cited verses of Apab, where Yahweh declared to Abraham that, quote, the Eternal One himself you will not see, the 14th century Christian illustrator of Apab seems to have had no qualms about representing God visually. Note the contrast between the beautifully rendered faces in the original illustration at left with the more simple and crude faces, the facsimile version at right. The individual pictured on the throne seems to be Christ. His identity is indicated by the cruciform markings on his nimbus. Behind the enthroned Christ is a second figure, perhaps Michael or Metatron. Beneath the throne are fiery seraphim and many-eyed wheels praising God. The throne is surrounded by a series of heavenly veils separating the Lord from the material world. Vision of the creation and the fall. At this point, Moses has shown the creation and the fall. Apab describes how Abraham looked down to see the affairs of what is called in modern Revelation, quote, the kingdoms of a lower order. The Lord's voice commanded Abraham to look, and quote, as the voice was still speaking, a series of heavenly veils were opened beneath his feet. Abraham has shown the heavenly plan for creation, the realization of the foreordained plan in the creation of the earth, the Garden of Eden, the fall of Adam and Eve, incited by Satan. Could it be that Moses 1 was revealed rather than simply imagined? With a generous openness to Joseph Smith's claim of the exercise of seeric gifts, Samuel Zinner, a non-Latter-day Saint who is a lifelong scholar of ancient scripture and pseudepigrapha, suggests that, quote, it might prove fruitful to apply to Joseph Smith's modern era scripture, Michael Stone's model, whereby he posits that at least some ancient post-canonical literature may have been created under the impact of visionary experiences rather than having been authored exclusively by imitating previous literary works, end of quote. Joseph Smith encouraged each of us to follow his example, quote, reading the experience of others or the revelation given to them, said the prophet, can never give us a comprehensive view of our condition and true relation to God. Knowledge of these things can only be obtained by experience through the ordinances of God set forth for that purpose. Could you gaze into heaven 5 minutes, you would know more than you would by reading all that was ever written on the subject, end of quote. May we be worthy someday of the blessings given to these great prophets about whom we've spoken today. Thank you.
Well, welcome, and thank you so very much for this wonderful presentation. First off, I wonder if, Stephen Whitlock, if you might just tell us a brief little bit about yourself and what your role in this paper was.
So I'm a retired cybersecurity professional, and I've been interested in the Pearl Great Price for a long time as well, and have collaborated with Jeff on some previous projects. I also did the photography.
Wonderful. And this paper is unique in that not only was it comparing an ancient text, but an illuminated manuscript as well, and it had beautiful illustrations in your presentation that you took. And I found it interesting because so often as scholars we fixate and focus a lot on the ancient texts and what written sources can tell us. But what role, for either of you, if you'd like to answer, what role would you say art and iconography can play in giving us more information about the ancient world in our Latter-day Saint scripture?
Well, I think there are things that can be shown visually that are much harder to describe in textual form. And not only are there the six illustrations, but they have their own text written on the sides of the illustrations, which is translated in the article.
I think as we showed in the vision of Abraham and Yahweh approaching the throne of God, sometimes the illustrations support the manuscript, and sometimes they don't, because the manuscript here, the text was telling us, you're never going to see God. That was, I guess, the opinion of the redactor, whereas the Christian illustrator had no problem with that, and that's very, very clear. I think another example was pointing out what was important in the text. That illustrator could have chosen dozens of scenes to illustrate, but as in the example of Abraham falling to the earth, he chose to illustrate that significant scene with, I think, some ritual as well as a narrative importance where he was raised from the earth by the angel Yahuwel.
Wonderful. Very interesting. And we've gotten a couple other questions from our audience. One of our viewers, Brad, noted that he wants to thank you for providing access to this conference. The focus on the Book of Moses is most intriguing and helpful. My question is, in that heading before chapter 1 of the Book of Moses, it states that the Book of Moses is an extract from the translation of the Bible. And he has a three-part question here. Was Oliver Cowdery also serving as a scribe during this translation of the Bible? Number two, do we know if this extract was received much in the same way as the translation of the Book of Mormon, i.e. seer stones, etc.? And the third part of this question is, how do we really address historicity of this book absent of any tangible historical material such as gold plates for the Book of Mormon? Am I just not aware of what tangible material came into play in bringing forth the Book of Moses? So that is a mouthful of a question. To reiterate the first part, was Oliver Cowdery serving as a scribe during this translation?
So let's start with that. I guess I'll say that the only tangible evidence that we have, other than the manuscript itself and the clues you can get from that, is that Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery, I think in preparation for the work of the Joseph Smith translation in October 1829, bought a Bible, a Finney Bible that at least Robert J. Matthews and some other scholars think was in preparation for that. Though the revelation didn't come till June, they were pretty busy in that time. They were finishing the publication of the Book of Mormon. The church was organized. They had the first conference. And then the mobbing started near the Harmony area. And so they really didn't have a time to think about it. It appears, however, that, the first question was Oliver Cowdery with the scribe? Yes, that at some point they got back to the translation effort during that busy period in June 1830, and Oliver Cowdery penned down the words that Joseph Smith received. Now, it seems evident from the text itself that it was brought down in very clear flowing style. You know, there aren't hesitations. There's a couple of corrections that were made later, but the main text seems to have just flowed. That's a typical thing for Joseph Smith, as some of the scribes of the Doctrine and Covenants have illustrated. And so that's to me evidence that it was dictated, and to other scholars such as Kent Jackson, all of a piece. It goes right into chapter 2 of the Joseph Smith translation. Other scholars, such as Thomas Wayman, think that it may have been a copy rather than an original, that original manuscript, in an Old Testament one. But I've recently written a review where we question some of those assumptions. They're not as strongly shared by the authors of the Joseph Smith papers, Colby Townsend and others, or myself. What was the second part?
Do we know if this extract was received much in the same way as the translation of the Book of Mormon, i.e. seer stones, or using the Urim and Thummim?
We don't have any evidence either way. We know that the Joseph Smith translation as a whole seems to have been created with Joseph sitting with the Bible in front of him and basically dictating any changes, and then where he departed from the text, he gave that text and then came back to it. Kent Jackson has recently had a chapter republished in the Interpreter Journal of, maybe it's coming up soon, maybe it's just happened, that goes into that process quite clearly. But no, we don't have any evidence about exactly how it came, except that it seems to have been a flowing, dictated revelation.
Very good. We have another question here. What is the relationship, if any, between the Book of Moshe and the Book of Ibrahim mentioned in the Quran and the Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham and the Pearl of Great Price?
Wow. So glad you talked about that. I don't think we have a time to go into this in detail here, but if you go to the footnotes in the published version of the article, I included as much of that as I could, as our editor could stand. There are already too many footnotes in there. But essentially, the opinion seems to be among Islamic scholars that those two books, which they call the books of the earliest revelation, if I got the phrase right, were not the books that we find in the Bible or the accounts we find in the Bible of Moses and Abraham, but may have been something similar to what we find in a heavenly ascent text, although probably not identical to the Book of Moses. But they had the flavor that they were some revelatory texts of Moses and Abraham. Did you have anything to add to that?
Yes. So more generally, I think it's likely that many of the major prophets, especially those introducing dispensations, had these experiences. And you might ask why we don't read more about that. And I think there are two reasons. First of all, they were very sacred, and so they probably weren't told to very many people or maybe written down. And in this year, when we celebrate the anniversary of Joseph Smith's first vision, there have been a lot of articles, and we know a lot about it, but I'm certain that we don't know everything that he saw. And secondly, I think some of these texts, at least for the Old Testament, I'm not sure about the Quran, were removed as the scriptures went through evolution and probably some apostasy.
Can I add one thing to your comment about the sacredness? There's a very interesting letter that Joseph Smith wrote to William W. Phelps that I think is very little known among church members. William W. Phelps loved to publish the Revelations and was busy correcting several things for Joseph Smith to publish them in Missouri. And he was anxious to see the Joseph Smith translation published. What's interesting is Joseph Smith's very stern reply. He said, "This new translation," I'm paraphrasing here because I can't remember the quote, "this new translation shall not go forth under my hand in my lifetime, and the word of the Lord be done, the will of the Lord be done." So I think it's clear that Joseph Smith eventually came to feel that the Lord would want him to prepare the manuscript for translation, but at some point in time, that early point, actually an area of time when they were well into the translation, Joseph Smith seemed to feel that the contents, and I would think at least, especially Moses 1, which was never published in the Times and Seasons, Moses 6 and 7 was published before Moses 1 was so sacred it should not be published to the world.
Very interesting. And going back to your point about the first vision, we've got lots of information about, and articles written about Joseph Smith's experience there and how sacred it was. But other people have also written about how it follows this similar prophetic pattern of receiving a prophetic call, being inducted into the divine council. And so, regardless of what prophetic experience we're talking about, they often follow these very similar.
It's cool that it's similar enough that we recognize the pattern. We say it's like Isaiah and others. On the other hand, it's different enough that we say this is totally unique. And then when we find an exemplar like Apab that actually follows this unique pattern, it makes it doubly marvelous in my view.
That's an excellent point. Another question we have is one question which is raised in the title, Twin Sons of Different Mothers. Do you see the relationship between Book of Moses and Apab as a matter of common genetic origins or as two examples of a once common sequence of motifs, or as two independent revelations that are similar because of the revelatory process?
I'm going to go with C.
Okay.
But basically similar experience for a prophet.
That would make a perfect sense.
I wouldn't say it's impossible, though, that in composing Apab, which is evidently very late, they didn't draw on earlier manuscripts and then inserted some questions about why Jerusalem was destroyed, why the temple was destroyed, why evil is allowed to reign, kind of following that experience as they assembled the text. So they may have, the Apab editors at least, may have drawn on some earlier things.
And the person points out that, you know, this is talking about Abraham's experience and we're comparing it with Moses' experience. And so, and you mentioned this a little bit in your talk, but where might users and viewers go to find more about how we can compare the apocalypse of Abraham with what we know about the Book of Abraham and Abraham as a figure in Scripture?
So a great source is Jared Ludlow's article in the one of the four volumes of the on the Book of Abraham that was published by the Maxwell Institute some years back. And I'm sure those are part of the Pearl of Great Price archive and bibliography if you want details, as they are part of the Moses 1 bibliography. Also, Hugh Nibley, of course, has written extensively about those things. But probably not as in as concentrated a fashion as Jared Ludlow's wonderful article.
Brother Hafen touched on this a little bit last night, talking about Moses 1 as being a temple text. And in your opinions, what would you say is a good way, or how can we better use Moses 1 to help people prepare for the temple, since it is such a beautiful temple text, as you've described in your paper?
So one of the things he said is he instructed temple goers to read it and prayerfully and pray about it before they went to the temple. I think if someone does that and then tries to interpret some of the symbolism and understanding, then when they go to the temple, it will be a richer experience.
Building on what Steve says, I think that it's important to realize that the temple endowment and the other aspects of temple worship are symbolic in nature. And I think it's important to understand symbols in general, as many people have pointed out. But I think just kind of seeing, there's eight of these, you're baptized when you're eight, and And just seeing those symbols individually is not nearly so powerful or as relevant for temple worshipers as to see the story as a whole, to see how those pieces fit together, how we go through this individual and corporate plan of salvation ourselves, and how we return to the presence of God. And understand that whole story, how it fits together, I think is a very powerful experience to me. And going to the temple, I get more out of the scriptures when I go to the temple, and I get more out of the temple when I study those scriptures.
One of my favorite things that Elder Hafen said last night was, you know, we talk so much about Christ in the gospel, why don't we see Christ more in the temple? And he made the point that, well, because the temple is about giving and receiving the atonement of Jesus Christ, and we do that by proxy through Adam and Eve. And I think in a similar way, we can feel the same things when we read the story of Moses. He is a microcosm for our journey in going back into the presence of God, and it's quite a remarkable thing that we have there in the book of Moses.
And Moses 1 sets the stage properly for the creation as discussed in the temple as well as in the scriptures, that it's not accidental or just a whim of God doing something, but it puts it in the proper perspective.
And that is an excellent point, because we've got so many accounts of creation between Genesis, Moses, the book of Abraham, and what we hear in the temple. It can be a little bit confusing, and so studying the book of Moses for those creation accounts, I think, can be really instructive as well. Another question is, we're wondering, Steve, if you might be willing to tell us a little bit about the process of photographing this beautiful illuminated manuscript so that we could have these illustrations today, and what things you might have learned in the process.
We didn't have much time, so having more time would have been better. The Oxford Library was fantastic, but we arrived there with about an hour before they closed. And so handheld, didn't have copy stands or anything. I would mention something interesting we learned about the manuscript, though. The Russian manuscript and the Oxford one have the same pagination, but the critical text, Rubinkiewicz, if I get his name right, there are 5 pages in a different order, approximately 30% of the way into the manuscript. And we have not figured out exactly what happened, because the Russian manuscript is a piece of the Codex Sylvester, which is a long, multiple hundred page codex that includes a whole bunch of different texts. And they're printed 2 to a page. And the pagination difference is in the odd pages, to where you'd have to tear the pages in Moscow in half to like rearrange them properly. So somehow something got changed, and yet the Moscow's the oldest edition of it. So I found that kind of interesting and a little difficult to track down, because I don't really read old Slavonic.
So to Steve's credit, I should give him this credit. He tracked through this old Slavonic, not being able to read it, until he could figure out what the difference in ordering of the pages was, which was an incredible, tedious, but wonderful task that nobody else has really written about that we're aware of. I want to say about the Russian manuscript, it was kind of interesting, because we thought we'd have a really hard time getting copies of those things. And finally, when we got the right agency, which had changed hands many times in the names and the administration bureaucracy, they responded promptly back with our request and said, yes, we can get those for you. I said, okay, how do we pay you? Do we do PayPal? Do we do Western Union or whatever? And they said, well, no, you need to come and pay in person. We said, well, that's going to be a little difficult. And so I said, what can we do? They said, oh, I know somebody who's in the German consulate for Russia, and he has a bank account in Frankfurt. So if you can wire the money to his bank account in Frankfurt, then he will pay on your behalf. I'll call him up and have him do that for you. So he brought in his rubles and did it. And I said, well, how much is it going to be? Because I just wondered if we were going to be taken. We would have been willing to pay any amount. I think it turned out to be something like $6.80. So we knew it was an honest process. And it was kind of cool, because those have never appeared anywhere before so far.
That's what I was about to mention. While the Apocalypse of Abraham has been studied a lot, these specific manuscripts have never been in print before. Is that correct?
The illustration, yeah, the illustrations, other than the facsimile.
That's remarkable, and what a great contribution. The text of these presentations will be available online. Will the full published paper with all the footnotes be as well, that users can scour through them, the whole 112 pages?
Well, it's already online at the interpreter.
Okay, wonderful. It's a fascinating paper and very long, and so users can really dive in if they want to learn more about these topics. And Well, I believe, okay, let's see, last question. Do you know of any other pieces of extra biblical literature that could have valuable comparison with the Book of Moses?
Well, if you're talking about Book of Moses as a whole, we're going to hear tons and tons of stuff. But I especially love the story of Enoch. People have pointed to 1 Enoch as being a very fruitful source of comparison. That's the only manuscript, ancient Enoch manuscript, that has been discovered so far that appeared in the lifetime of Joseph Smith, even though, in my view, it's unlikely he could have ever seen it. But the parallels there and the resemblances are fairly loose compared to ones that were found even in the 20th century. So my favorite ancient manuscript for the Book of Moses happens to be something, a Dead Sea Scroll called the Book of Giants. And you can read a lot of the interesting relationships between that and the chapter 6 and 7 of Book of Moses in the insights that have already been published on Book of Mormon Central and in the talk that Jared Ludlow is going to give at the end of the day today.